This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
It's tax day. We talk about that now on Tactics. Good morning. Welcome into Tactics. I'm Caleb Colquitt. You are listening to News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. Certainly glad to have you in on this Tuesday morning, which is starting to feel a little bit warmer, which is encouraging, I know, for a lot of you. Frankly, I don't mind the cold. I'm perfectly fine with it. I'm a little odd in that way. Some people think that I may not be truly Alabamian because of that, but nonetheless, I do enjoy good cold weather, and frankly, I'm kind of sad to see it start to go. But nonetheless, something that a lot of you I know are excited about, and something that I know a lot of you are not excited about would have to be that today is tax day. And I do think that this is hilarious because liberals have often referred to this as, have in the past referred to this, I think this was about 2 or 3 years ago when they started saying this, that it's the greatest single day of charity, which is hilarious because if you understand charity to mean the way that the Bible defines it, this is the exact opposite of charity. Nowhere in the Bible does it condone taking money from other people and giving it to other people and calling that charity. Charity is something that you do of your own volition, of your own free will, that, in fact, the Bible specifically states in a couple of different places that charity that is not done voluntarily doesn't count. That if you give out of grudgingness or of necessity, in other words, you feel obligated to give, or you are having to give because you have no other choice, that by definition is not giving, at least the way the Bible describes it. But of course, today is tax day. And one thing that I wanted to talk about very quickly, and we probably will move on because there's a lot to talk about with Syria. There's a lot to talk about with other world events. And I do want to move on to that. But one of the reasons that I thought it was important to take some time to talk about tax day is I do find it somewhat ironic that especially the left, when it comes to taxes, they believe as though that equal protection under the law is something that is essential, it is sacred, and it's something that I agree with the left on when they talk about this, but for some reason, they believe that it is perfectly all right to throw that completely out the window when it comes to their tax system. And that's why they support a heavily progressive tax, which, by the way, is one of the 10 pillars of communism. So our current tax system, and yes, even including the new one, while it is a step in the right direction, it's a baby step in the right direction. Our current tax system, which taxes people more based on their level of success, how much money they make, is literally, and I am not using hyperbole or anything like that, it is literally one of the 10 pillars of communism. A heavy progressive tax is one of the 10 key components to communist society. You can read it. It's straight out of the Communist Manifesto. In my copy, it's page 31. You can look at that. And that. So our tax system currently is actually designed by Karl Marx. He's the one that originated the idea of a heavy progressive tax to where you pay a larger percentage of your income the higher up in the tax bracket that you get. And so this idea that for some reason that the progressive tax is a good idea, it literally comes straight out of Marxism. And another issue that our current tax system has, because the idea of a progressive tax is that it punishes those evil, dirty rich people, which there's a couple of problems there. First of all, why punish rich people? Why punish their level of success? Why punish them for being more productive than people who make less than they do? That makes no sense. But even if it did make sense, let's just pretend for the sake of argument, let's accept their premise that it was something that we ought to do. We ought to be punishing the rich people, that we ought to be figuring out a way to bring about some kind of significant change because of that, that we ought to be doing the best that we can to make sure that rich people don't acquire any more capital or whatever else it may be, which there's several reasons that that particular world outlook is wrong. But let's just accept that part of the argument that they typically make for a moment and imagine that that is correct. The progressive tax system does not do that. Even though that is what it's designed to do, even though that is the stated goal, is to redistribute wealth from people with more income to people with less income, it really doesn't do that. And here's what I mean by that. The way that it works, to where you graduate up, in other words, you start making more money, and because of that, you move into a higher tax bracket and are taxed more, it does not stop wealth. All it does, especially with the convoluted system that we have now and the thousands of pages of regulation and tax breaks, the way that it works right now is that it does not prevent wealth. It prevents becoming wealthy. That's really the only thing that it stops. Because the people that are already at the top, the people that already make a lot of money, people, even though they would hate to admit it to themselves, people that are in the 1% like Bernie Sanders, like Elizabeth Warren, like the Clintons, people that make a ridiculous amount of money and make far more than they could ever spend, those people are protected by the system. And the reason that they are protected by the system is because, think of it like this. Is it easier to hide in a dense jungle or a freshly manicured lawn? It's really difficult to hide in a big open space. It's difficult to hide in somewhere that you have nothing to hide behind, nothing to conceal yourself. And a progressive tax system, especially one with all the tax breaks, with all the deductions that we have now, it's basically like a really complicated large jungle. And the people who are rich enough to afford the attorneys, that are rich enough to afford the accountants and the team of specialists that they hire to handle their taxes, they are shielded because there are so many places in the tax code to hide. Our tax code is thousands upon thousands upon thousands of pages. And these attorneys, and I'm not blaming them, they're actually doing their job. It's the system itself that is corrupt. And so when you have the tax attorneys, when you have the tax accountants and the specialists that look through this stuff, they say, well, if we move your assets over here, then you're going to be shielded. And if you claim your house like this is a farm, you're going to get this amount of deductions. And if you claim this on your taxes, then you're going to get this. And so what winds up happening is the richest wind up paying pretty much the same tax rate as a lot of the lower brackets. I was reading reports, and of course these are anecdotal stories, but they're indicative of things that happen all the time with people that are richer. Multi-billionaires that are paying like 15% of their income in taxes. Now again, I have no problem with a multi-billionaire paying 15% in taxes. But the irony in all of this is that they try to make a ridiculous burden of close to 40% for the highest tax bracket, and it winds up not helping them anyway. Because, again, rich people have a way between their teams of attorneys and accountants to work around that. So what does it really prevent? What does the progressive taxism tax idea really do? It really just prevents wealth creation. Because what you've got are people that are making money, but maybe not making that much money, that are making, you know, maybe six figures or something like that, that are trying to work their way up. They don't have the resources to hide in the tax code like the people at the top do. And so what happens to them is they get taxed at those ridiculous rates, and that acts as a barrier to further success. It acts as a barrier for them to be able to make their way higher in the system, because they are making enough to where they're being taxed to death, but they're not making quite enough to where they can hire all the people that they need to and be able to have all the resources at their fingertips to, for example, move money around into offshore accounts, that kind of thing. And so because of that, because they don't have those resources made available to them, they're getting hit by the heavy progressive tax and are not able to move further up and to make more money. So really the only thing that the progressive tax does, it doesn't really hurt rich people. What I mean by that is the uber rich. It hurts the people that are doing pretty well, but not nearly well enough to reach that really high level. And so that's part of the reason that the progressive tax ironically doesn't even do that which progressives wish it to do. to punish the rich. It's a system that sustains itself by allowing the rich people to keep most of what they have through technicalities. But the people that are working really hard trying to get to that next level of wealth, they can't do so because that acts as a very high hurdle for them. I mean, of course, there are people that overcome that hurdle. You've got people like a great example that we've seen a lot in the media lately is Mark Zuckerberg, who became kind of an overnight success with Facebook. I mean, it took a couple years, but the point is he was so wealthy and his idea was so profitable that he was able to leap over that hurdle. But a lot of people can't. A lot of people that are doing well, a big obstacle for them doing better is the progressive tax system. And so what you've got here is a tax system that doesn't really prevent wealth, but it certainly prevents the creation of new wealth. It certainly prevents people that are doing pretty well from doing better. And sadly, it disincentivizes people from moving up. This is a personal story that I remember from my childhood. At one point, my dad was actually offered a raise and turned it down because after he looked into it, it was going to move him into the next tax bracket and he would actually be technically bringing home less. His check would actually be less when he brought it home because he was moving into that next tax bracket. And so he had to basically drop back and punt on that. And think about how crazy that is. Somebody that actually wanted to take less pay than they were being offered, specifically because if they took that raise because of the way the taxes work, their bring home money, the money that they actually took home in their check every month, was going to be less. This is why I have long been an advocate for and continue to be an advocate for a rehaul of the tax system. And people have argued back and forth whether a fair tax, which is a consumption tax, is better. Some people are really big fans of that. Some people prefer the flat tax. I tend to fall closer to the flat tax idea. I think that that's a more fair way to handle it. Just because it's a 10% across the board, that means that rich people are still paying far more than poor people, because 10% of their money is way more than 10% of the people at the bottom's money. But the point is, everybody's paying 10%. And if that's the way that it is, sure, there are going to be people that are able to hide some of their assets, but it won't be nearly to the point, and nor would they have near the incentive to do so as they would with our current tax system. So they wouldn't have the ability to hide nearly as much because it's very simple, out in the open. It's not convoluted. There's not a lot of places to hide in the tax code. And furthermore, they have less incentive to do so because it's only 10% of their income, not 40%. And so it's less profitable to hire that team of attorneys and lawyers to try to find all these hiding places, because the threshold for which you are profiting off of that is far, far less. And so that's the system that I favor. But either one, either a consumption tax or a flat tax, would be far preferable. And I think that you could do that and scale back the IRS to basically nothing. I mean, I could see us still having an IRS, but it wouldn't need nearly the staff. And it would be far simpler and far harder for the IRS to abuse their power, like we recently saw in the Lois Lerner case. If we were able to do that, it would greatly improve business, it would greatly improve personal wealth, and it would improve the country overall. And history has shown it would also actually, ironically, increase tax revenue. We would actually be bringing in more money for the federal government to spend, because we would be creating new wealth and new taxpayers, as opposed to just trying to tax the taxpayers that we already have for more of their income. So there's a lot of positive here. What do you think about this? Do you have any comments on tax day? 860-1440. We will be right back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The doctrines of Jesus are simple and tend all to the happiness of man. Thomas Jefferson.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in. And normally I would tell you that you can follow me at Tactics Radio on Twitter, which I assume you can still do. Although I'm not sure exactly why, but it looks like Twitter is down right now. I can't even get to the homepage here, and it's not my internet connection, it's Twitter specifically. They're saying that they're having technical difficulties, so I probably can't take your tweets right now. Now, is this the retaliation from Russia? Maybe this is the cyber attack? Well, I doubt it, but I don't know. very much doubt that that's the case, but for whatever reason, Twitter is down right now. I assume that they're having some kind of technical difficulty. But nonetheless, I do want to actually talk about what's going on the world stage there. There's a couple things that I wanted to mention, and I actually did want to talk about this yesterday, but sadly I ran out of time, and that does happen sometimes on a live radio show. The constitutionality of something that is going on in Syria right now, that's actually something that I did not get a chance to address yesterday. And you have to keep in mind, this is not in any way condemning the action itself, but rather how you got there. So in other words, I'm not saying necessarily that I thought it was a horrible idea to respond in this fashion, because like I said before, even though it remains to be seen whether or not this was the wisest strategy, I guess we'll know in hindsight. But I do think that when the president says something, he needs to back it up. I do think that there was some kind of action for sure that needed to be taken against Syria in this respect. But if you're looking at the Constitution, I do not like the president acting unilaterally like this because it exceeds his constitutional authority. Declaring war and acts of aggression, which this was because Syria didn't attack us, are not something that the president is allowed to respond to. He's not allowed to respond in force. Now, he is the commander in chief. He can say whatever he wants as far as if we are in war, he does have the right to command the troops. That is part of his job, according to Article 2 of the Constitution. However, one thing that is clear in the Constitution, and this remains in Article 1, is the actual declaration of war, the decision to engage in warfare against other countries. That is something that, according to the Constitution, is solely and exclusively left up to the Congress. The Congress is supposed to decide that. And I hate that we're in a situation to where there would be congressmen that would probably vote against the president. I don't know if it would be enough to actually stop an act of war, but that would vote against the president simply because they don't like the president and wouldn't put the security of our country first. But that is what the Constitution prescribes. And if it were a serious enough threat, if it were something that were dire, then I do believe that even though the left does have a disdain for the right and vice versa, that there would be at least enough congressmen to put their own personal feelings aside to do the right thing if that's the decision that it came to. For example, you have events like Pearl Harbor, like 9/11, to where I don't believe that anybody would say that there does not need to be some kind of reaction militarily to that. And so that's really where I stand on it. The president is the commander in chief, but he does not have the constitutional ability to declare war. He needs congressional approval for that. And the president can react to certain things, but this, again, was not something that harmed Americans. This was not an act of aggression. And unfortunately, this rule has been pretty much ignored since World War II, maybe with a bit of an exception with Afghanistan, but President Trump is not the only one to have done this.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com.
Galatians 5, 13 and 14. For you were called to freedom, brethren. Only do not turn your freedom into an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. For the whole law is fulfilled in one word, in the statement, you shall love your neighbor as yourself.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440, that is the way to get in touch with me. And as soon as Twitter gets back up, I don't know why they're down right now, but it is just them. They're experiencing some kind of technical difficulty, I assume. That's what they say anyway. So as soon as that gets back up, you'll be able to tweet me at Tactics Radio. You know, as a substitute for Twitter, if you happen to not be able to get through on Twitter, as always, you can still get in touch with me over Facebook at facebook.com/tacticsradio. So you do that, and if you're inclined to do so, feel free to get in touch with me that way. So what all is going on in Syria? There's a I think, a very important aspect of this story that has gone largely unreported, or at least underreported. And a lot of that has to do with what's going on right now between Israel and Iran. Because that's the story that not a lot of people are talking about. And Israel and Iran are certainly players. They've been mentioned in that sense, but I don't think people really fully grasp the gravity of what is going on between these two. Because you have to keep in mind, for Russia and the United States, the stakes are very high, but also the events of Syria are largely symbolic. You know, we did strike a blow against Syria's chemical weapons program, but it's not as though we decimated it. And when it comes to Russia, to them, the stakes are high because they want to look good on the world stage. They want to look like they're really in control of the Syrian area. They want to try to paint the Americans as the bad guys and the interlopers and so on and so forth. But again, for them, the stakes really are, they pretty much stop at the point of it makes them look good on the world stage or it makes them look bad on the world stage. And with the U.S., we're trying to curb and prevent people from using chemical weapons in the future and use this as a deterrent, a cautionary tale. If you do this, this is what is going to happen when it comes to chemical weapons. But again, in both cases, the stakes are high, and it is going to escalate tensions between our two countries, which could lead to something bigger. But they are largely symbolic. Whether or not America has control of Syria, I don't think that that's actually something that we're vying for. But whether America has control of Syria or Russia has control of Syria, it's not exactly a strategic juggernaut or something that's imperative that we have to gain one advantage over the other. Like I said, this is a largely symbolic gesture on both sides. What is not symbolic at all is whether or not Iran has influence in Syria. And the reason that I say that is because one of the key missions of Iran, the Iranian government, this is actually in their constitution. They want to destroy the state of Israel and wipe it from the face of the earth. So what's stopping them? Well, a couple of things. First of all, they know that there would be a ridiculous fallout from us, and they should expect that if they attack our ally Israel. But another big part of that, and the reason that they have not done this yet, is because it's very difficult for them to. Why? Because of how far away they are. It's not a ridiculous distance, but you have to keep in mind when you're dealing with Iran and they don't have nearly the sophisticated weapon systems, nor do they have the reach of, for example, the American Navy or Air Force. Well, a sneak attack on Israel is pretty tough to pull off. Because they do lack that technology, and because Israel has much better technology, in part because of us and the Iron Dome and so on and so forth. But what is really stopping Iran from accomplishing their goal of completely destroying Israel is the fact that they're so far away and that a sneak attack, a stealth attack like that would be very difficult because of the distance. And a land invasion would also be very difficult. Israel would know about it ahead of time. It would be something that they would have to be moving troops through several different countries to do so. Syria, on the other hand, is not a nation that borders Israel, but it's certainly much closer. And if you were to launch some kind of missile or some kind of weapon from that distance, it would be much harder for them to defend against because it's closer, it takes less time to get there. And so for Israel and Iran, who is in charge of Syria and who has influence in that region is a much bigger deal. In fact, to them, it is a matter of survival. And say what you want to about Syria, but it is not a matter of survival for us. Now, theoretically, and this is something that I've talked about on the program yesterday, theoretically, it could wind up leading to World War III, and then it certainly is a matter of survival. But just what is going on in Syria itself right now, just looking at it from only that standpoint, is not a matter of survival for us. This is not a life or death situation for us. That is exactly what it is for the state of Israel. And Iran, because they do want to destroy Israel, but it's almost impossible right now, And because Syria would be a strategic advantage, it would be something that is much closer for them. You have another thing that kind of plays into this is that Iran has been promoting this amongst the other Muslim nations for some time now, and they want to kind of be the leader. They want to be the one in charge. The Ayatollahs are pushing this with other Muslims, basically trying to drum them up to encircle Israel, to have them to where they're cornered. And this has been at least partially accomplished right now because of the Israel-Gaza border. For those of you who are unaware and you haven't seen a whole lot of coverage of it, except some negative coverage, and we'll get to that in a second. There have been protests going on for weeks now on the Gaza border with Israel. And the only coverage that you're really seeing is when Israel retaliates, for example, when they have shot people that are out there protesting, when they've shot, you know, crowd control elements like tear gas, that kind of thing. And what they're not showing you is what happens right before that. Because in several cases, there have been people trying to tear down the wall on the border there. There have been people trying to invade the country, you know, rioting, attacking Israeli soldiers, that kind of thing. And so that's going on. And what are these crowds chanting? Why are they there? One of the ones that was kind of creepy, we've seen video footage of them praising Iran's general that is in charge of essentially the anti-Israel forces, because Iran specifically has forces that are just dealing with how to destroy Israel. That's how dedicated they are to destroying the state of Israel. And at some point you can actually watch video, this is on the internet, of those protesters chanting the name of the general that's in charge of that force. Now, it's in some form of Aramaic, I assume. I don't recognize the language. But the point is, this is all something that is coordinated. And the, quote, return to Israel campaign, which is what this is being called, centers around the idea that they are going to retake Jerusalem, they're going to return to Jerusalem. And when is this all supposed to take place? When is this supposed to reach its head? On May the 14th. Because that's Israel Independence Day. I believe this one will be the 70th anniversary of Israeli Independence Day, when the State of Israel was reestablished and declared itself independent. And what also happens on May the 14th? That is the day that it is at least right now scheduled for the new U.S. embassy to open in Jerusalem, because you remember this was a big news story from last year. The president said that we are going to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem because that is the capital of Israel. And this became a big hoopla. I don't understand why this is controversial. Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. Has been for a long time. That's where all their government officials are. Jerusalem is a city in Israel. And so that being said, and looking into understanding that that is something that is going to be very significant for the state of Israel, there's probably something being planned around that, and they already have said that's when the protest is going to culminate. So keep your eye on that. Watch for that. And that is part of the reason that Iran wants so desperately to go ahead and lock this up and get their claws into Syria. Because if they were going to plan an attack, especially on this day, it would be a huge strategic advantage for them to be this close by, for them to be able to have influence in this region, maybe move some weapons over there, move some missiles over there, be able to attack Israel at a much closer range. I'm not saying 100% that that's their goal, but that seems to be the most logical explanation for the reason that Iran has invested so much in having influence in Syria. And they know that Bashar al-Assad is not somebody that's friendly to Israel anyway, and so he would be sympathetic to their cause. That's part of the reason that they want him to remain in power. He's one of their allies. And so while we've all been talking about this and what this means for our country, how this is going to make us look on the world stage, all very important things, things that I've spent quite a bit of airtime talking about. Really, let's pray for Israel, because the stakes are high for us, but to them, This is absolutely, without question, a matter of life and death. Pray for the people of Israel. 860-1440. We'll be right back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
My hopes of a future life are all founded upon the gospel of Christ. John Quincy Adams.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, that is the way to get in touch with me if you want to call. Also, you can tweet me at Tactics Radio, and Twitter's back. So I guess Russia's evil plans to take down Twitter fell. No, I'm kidding. I doubt that that had anything to do with that whatsoever. I just thought it was funny that when we were talking about that, Twitter actually went down. The Russians are probably listening to this broadcast right now and trying to shut us down. But nonetheless, we shall persist. We shall soldier on. In all seriousness, though, what's going on? I do actually think that this is pretty funny. And here's why. The Democrats, back in March, they were all talking about how Trump is really in the bag for Putin, that he's just a Putin puppet. He is a tool of the Kremlin. And this month, ironically, what you're seeing is them essentially having to make the exact opposite case that Putin, that they're saying that Trump is crazy. He's going to get us into World War III with Russia. So here's the question that I have. Either Trump is way too soft on Russia, or he's so harsh on Russia that he's going to get us into World War III. You can't have it both ways. It's one or the other. Because that's really an issue that they're going to have. Where does this go? Seriously, where does this go if you believe that there is this Russian collusion, that Russia got Trump elected and they did so basically expecting favors afterward? Because that's the narrative that we've been hearing for some time now. They've kind of backed off on it some because they realize how ridiculous it is the longer that the Mueller investigation goes on and doesn't really unearth anything specifically on Trump or some kind of deal. And so you've seen them kind of try to back off on that and focus more on the Cohen, Stormy Daniels story, that kind of thing. But as of right now, the predominant Democrat narrative is still that really Trump didn't win the election fair and square. He cheated and there was Russian involvement and he made a deal with the Russians and Russia has something on Trump and that's why he's working with them. I mean, for goodness sake, even James Comey said, well, I can't say for sure that Russia doesn't have some kind of influence over the president. Well, I can't say for sure that either. I couldn't have said that for sure during the Obama administration. That doesn't mean I have evidence that suggests that that is the case. There's a difference in being, because you can never prove a negative. That's an issue, logically, if you understand this, if you've studied debate, if you've studied logic, you cannot prove a negative. Ergo, the claim must be always, the burden of proof must always be on the claim giver. So if Comey's going to claim, for example, that Russia has some kind of influence over Trump, he needs to provide evidence to support that. The burden of proof is on him, not the burden of proof. It is not that the burden of proof is on other people to prove that something did not happen or something is not happening. And that's the way legally it's supposed to be as well. You're not declared, for example, innocent. You're not supposed to prove your innocence. You're supposed to show that there is not enough evidence to convict you, that you are not guilty. That's why our legal wording is the way that it is. But nonetheless, I did want to talk about this, and this is something that really I have been baffled about, and I have a hard time understanding. Actually, it's funny. It was the first thing that Kevin and I talked about. We have about maybe 3 or 4 minutes between the show that we kind of chew the fat while he's moving out and I'm setting up all my equipment in here between shows. And he said, what's going on with Sean Hannity? And I just looked at him and said, I got to be honest. I've been reading the story. I've been trying to follow it. And I don't get why it's significant. I really don't. Because people keep talking about it like it's this deep, dark secret that there was this massive bombshell reveal that Sean Hannity was also a client of Michael Cohen. Why? What significance does that play in the narrative? Does that make Sean Hannity look guilty of something? Does that make Donald Trump look guilty of something? I'm really confused, and maybe somebody can call in and explain it to me, 860-1440, if you want to weigh in, if you want to explain this to me. But I'm looking at this story, and I just frankly don't see why this is a big deal. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not somebody that is going to defend Sean Hannity no matter what. He appears on this station. I think he's a pretty good talk show host. He's somebody even that I look up to, at least as far as his broadcasting skill. Now, politically, he and I have disagreed quite a bit, especially in the election. Keep in mind that in the election, I was a never Trumper, and he was about as avidly pro-Trump as a person can be. And so I have at times certainly taken issue with Hannity and the way that he has handled things, the way that he has handled issues. But I don't at all see why Sean Hannity, being a former client of this guy, makes any difference. I'm not trying to conceal anything. I'm not trying to stick up for him. I genuinely don't understand what the significance is. And I keep getting all these different reports about talking about it and trying to confirm it. Of course, Sean Hannity says, well, you know, I haven't keeping this guy on retainer. I've never actually paid him for anything. Apparently he has met with him before and talked to him in the context of being a client and an attorney, but he's never actually paid him for his services and he's never been represented by Michael Cohen. So I really don't understand why this is a big deal. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's some key element or key detail that I'm completely missing, but as of yet, I don't see why this is a big deal. Maybe our next caller does. Let's go to the phones. Good morning. What's your name?
Tim. Good morning to you.
Hey, Tim. What's on your mind this morning?
Hey, listen, I don't see the significance of Hannity either, other than how he presented it, you know, as if he had no contact, no relationship with him, and as we now know, he has all along. I suspect Hannity's probably been involved in a lot of skin doctoring, you know, but so that doesn't really concern me about Hannity. That doesn't make that much of a difference to me. I really will tell you, though, and I'd love to hear your answer on this.
Sure.
Why has Trump refused to release his tax records? That's very significant to me because I think it'd be quite revealing from his taxes what his real relationship is with Russia. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know if there's anything contained within it whatsoever on Russia. It's important to keep in mind that Trump is a businessman. He has done business in Russia like a lot of other, you know, big businessmen have, that he has done business in multiple countries. The whole thing about the tax return, and I think that it's funny that this is getting brought up on tax day. The thing about the tax return is he is not legally obligated to release them. There's absolutely nothing that says that because you are a public official or president that you must release your tax returns. That's something that traditionally is done a lot to kind of show that they're on the up and up. As to why Donald Trump is concealing his tax records, I'm sorry, Tim, but I don't have a good answer for you. I think the only person that would have a good answer for you, if he were willing to tell you why, would be Donald Trump. Now, I think that Trump is correct in saying, and he has mentioned this before, that even if his tax records were completely clean, that he would get scrutiny for that regardless, just because they're going to scrutinize absolutely everything that he does. I think that that is a fair assessment by the president. He's right about that, and he may just not want to deal with the headache. If you want my honest opinion, what I think is going on, I think that it's an ego thing for him, because it has long been in dispute how much money Donald Trump actually makes and how much he's actually worth. I think he tries to present it as larger than it is. And because it would be embarrassing for him, that's why I think he hasn't released his tax returns. Hour two coming up.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
Some people, even Trump loyalists, are starting to turn on him because of what's going on with Russia. We talk about one in particular on Tactics.
Well, this train.
Welcome back. You are listening to Hour 2 of Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. Welcome back to the Situation Room. Glad to be with you on this Tuesday morning. It's not quite gone yet, Lynyrd Skynyrd, but don't worry. We are quickly approaching that in Hour 2. By the way, just real quick before we get into this next segment, a couple housekeeping things real quick. We've got a representative from the Montgomery Biscuits coming in tomorrow to talk about their new season. Really excited about that, having a guest in studio. And we also have, it's supposed to be tomorrow, I'm trying to confirm this, Rhonda Walker is supposed to be in. I'm not sure exactly what time yet because we're having some issues with our two guests. But Rhonda Walker, who is running to replace Senator Brubaker, of course, Senator Brubaker retiring, no longer going to be a member of the Senate in the great state of Alabama, and so she is running to replace him. We're going to get to talk to her, get her opinions on what is going on in the state exactly, what her take is on some of the issues that have been come up recently in the legislature. So certainly looking forward to that. And we're going to try to get all the candidates, her opponents as well, on the air before the primary, which is, I got to say, it is approaching much faster than I thought it would. June 5th is on its way, and there is a lot of ground to cover. So be sure to stay tuned to News Radio 1440 between me and Kevin. We'll try to get you all the local news, all the candidates, get interviews with them so you can make an informed decision. Now, that being said, with the Syria bombings, the aftermath, everything that's going on, there is one Trump supporter in particular that has now turned on Trump, or at least mostly turned on Trump, according to him, that he has changed his mind about Trump and what exactly is going on. This is Alex Jones. And I'm going to give you a fair warning. I've bleeped everything out, but you can only hear like maybe 10 words in this entire two or three minute clip, because we're just going to go through a little bit of it. This is really honestly more for my entertainment than anything else, because he is clearly off his rocker. But Alex Jones commenting on the Syria bombings, this is actually before his broadcast starts. It was just that the cameras happen to be rolling when he says this. So we'll probably play, probably not all of it, but we'll play some of it to give you an indication of how much foul language there is in this one clip. It's about maybe 3 minutes long in its totality. I think it took me about 20 minutes to edit the whole thing because I had to edit out so much of it. But anyway, this is just an idea. Alex Jones in reaction to the Syria bombings. This is actually Friday night when they were taking place.
This is the military-industrial complex. This is the same crap happened with Hitler or the Soviets. I mean, you got a bunch of power and weapons, so you got to take over everywhere. The rebels are Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Our own government funded them to take over the Middle East from Libya to Egypt to Syria. And Assad is pro-diversity, pro-religious freedom. They stood up. They beat it. The Russians were pulling out. And then Trump says a week ago he's pulling out of Syria, and then they start this crap. And they go, sir, we've raided your offices. We know about, you know, 20 years ago where you paid Atlantic City $100,000 at your casino. That's what they did. They grabbed his lawyer's documents. And none of it's even corruption, but according to the FBI, they can say, oh, you didn't say that was a... They got it. They rolled Trump.
Okay, so real quick before we continue on, a couple things to unpack there. First of all, in whatever crazy mind, it's hard to really wrap your head around what Alex Jones thinks, because the guy's mind is a bag of cats and he changes his mind about every 10 seconds. But nonetheless, when he goes to Assad, somehow in his mind he has reached the conclusion that Assad really is a good guy. He's pro-diversity. He's pro-religious freedom. I don't know what Assad he's talking about, but if you read the things that Assad has actually said and look at his actions and look at what he's done, that is clearly not the case. But one thing that he is attributing this whole thing, because Alex Jones never met a conspiracy theory he didn't like, is that every bad thing that Assad has done, whether it's the chemical weapons or whatever, that that's all staged, that it's not really Assad doing it, that Assad's the good guy. He's the one standing up against ISIS and standing up against the rebels, which he has actually fought against ISIS, but not for benevolent reasons, not because they're hurting people, because they are a threat to his power. So that is in part a problem with this narrative that unfortunately we do a lot here in America as well, is this idea that in every story there must be a hero and a villain. Sometimes there's just really bad people fighting each other because they're jealous of the power that is taking place here. And the Syrian rebels that eventually became ISIS, clearly not good guys. Bashar al-Assad, also not a good guy. He just didn't want the other bad guy to take his power from him. So there doesn't always have to be a hero and a villain in every narrative. Just because Assad was fighting ISIS does not make him a good person. You know, you have rival gangs, for example, in large cities fighting each other. That does not mean either gang is good just because they don't like each other. And so his theory is that that's what's going on, and that somehow they, according to him, rolled Trump and they got something on him. They raided the offices, and because of that, that's why Trump made the decision that he did. And they've secretly got something on Trump, which is ironic because he says, well, there's not any corruption, but they've got something on him. Well, if there's no corruption, then what do they have to blackmail him with? Now, again, I don't subscribe to the theory anyway. I don't think that there is necessarily anything corrupt that they found in Michael Cohen's records. But the point is, his idea is that even though there's no corruption, they found something and they're threatening Trump, and that's why they were able to convince him to do this. But anyway, let's continue on, because some of this afterward is just gold.
And he didn't stand up at the moment of truth. Donald Trump his pants at the moment of truth and all over everybody. That's my first approximation. I'm not in a cult for Donald Trump. Him, his family, all these people. All right, see, I shouldn't even be live right now. When are we going on the satellite? What the? Is there nobody here in this world? See, not I'm.
See,
now, Syria fought al-Qaeda, they fought ISIS, they fought it all, and now you got Mattis and all these people all over us. Every major analyst, see, I shouldn't even be on there right now.
You and I agree.
Every analyst agrees that this could trigger World War III unlike anything in our history, and the Russians were the good guys battling ISIS and al-Qaeda. I'm not a Russophile, I've never been to Russia. But I've studied the geopolitics. They are the white knights.
Oh, brother.
And our military 5 years ago joining the Russians to block Obama and the Arab Spring and do the right thing, did the right thing. And now Mattis and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and Trump have from end to end all over it. And don't think they don't know. I mean, Fast and Furious was Obama shipping guns into Mexico to transship them in the Middle East. Benghazi was all about this. I am. Trump was so on target, everything he did. And I will leave 10% judgment here to see what happens. But my first approximation is, my pledge to you is, I'm going to shoot you straight on Facebook and Twitter. And I am sick to my stomach right now. And Mattis looks like a Emperor Palpatine. When that knows full well that al-Qaeda and ISIS staged all those chemical attacks, and now they're blaming it on the I shouldn't be on air right now. When the are we going live? I can't do this anymore.
All right, that's enough. I can't take any more of it. But so there's a how he got to the point to where somehow in his mind, and I think this is actually pretty interesting because it shows that Alex Jones' true loyalty actually was never to Trump, which is fascinating to me, or at least it seems that way based on this one clip. Maybe something that comes out after this will prove otherwise, but it shows that actually he wasn't so much loyal to Trump as he was loyal to Russia, and he only liked Trump because he believed that Trump was sympathetic to Russia, that he was on Russia's side, and because he is no longer on Russia's side, his true loyalty lies with Russia. And so he's, now that Trump is, at least seemingly to him, the enemy of Russia, now he is against Trump because he's pro-Russia to the bitter end, which is ironic because he claims to be uber-patriotic and about America first and all these different things that he talks about on his broadcast. It seems to me that he's going to side with Russia over America when given the opportunity. And he says, well, I'm not in a cult for Trump. I'm not a Russian operative. I've never been to Russia. Well, maybe not, but it shows that your real loyalty is with them. He thinks that they are the white knights. And he says every single analyst agrees with this. There might be some that do, but honestly, I've never run into one that believes that Russia are the good guys in this whole situation. Russia, who routinely, with Vladimir Putin, kills journalists, kills their own operatives if they believe that they have done something like we saw in the UK. They kill any kind of political opponent to Putin. You're not allowed to speak out against Putin. They have control over the media so that he can control the messaging. I mean, nothing happens in Russia without the Kremlin's approval. There's really no freedom in Russia. You could argue that it's maybe freer than it used to be as the Soviet Union, but the way that Putin runs things, not really. I mean, the guy is absolutely a brutal political figure that goes after anyone that opposes him that he has the power to snuff them out. The guy's a gang leader. And somehow, in Alex Jones's crazy backward way of thinking, they've become the White Knights. I will, right before we go to a break, just play this last one by Alex Jones. This is actually when he is on air. This is after this happened. So this is Alex Jones. We'll play one last quick clip. This is a different one.
You know, stop supporting Trump. And it's the opposite of what my ex-wife says. She says, you know, oh, the system took the kids away from me. No, you got the kids back because of who I was part of the time. And then they sit there and they're like, you know, if you just turn against Trump, things will be better. But he was doing good, and that what makes it so bad.
Okay, you can see the visual. He's so crying bad. Here.
If he'd have been a piece of crap from the beginning, it would be so bad. But we made so many sacrifices, and now he's crapping all over us. It makes me sick.
So the point in playing all this and really what this gets back to, because, I mean, clearly this is an individual that is emotionally unstable. I don't think that there's any way that you can watch these clips or listen to these clips and get any other conclusion from that. And granted, because of that, this makes him an extreme case when it comes to his support of Donald Trump and the reasons that he does so, because I don't think this is anywhere close to indicative of the average Trump supporter, the average Trump voter. So don't get that impression. I'm giving Alex Jones as an extreme example on the fringes. But this is why, because a lot of people look to Alex Jones, they listen to Alex Jones, and even though he does not have a large movement, he has a movement that is at least politically significant. I mean, the guy stays on air. He does make enough money based on his subscribers and people that listen to him. And some people, because he does actually have a nice studio, people that wouldn't know better might see him as a legitimate news source. And so that is why this is significant. I mean, for goodness sake, the president himself legitimized him to a great degree by referencing him and talking about him as a good source of information, which was, I think, incredibly irresponsible of Donald Trump back on the campaign trail when he did this. But really what this all goes back to, and I think this is the lesson that you can take away from it, because Alex Jones is clearly distraught because talking about how Trump was on point with everything and he's so upset that he's actually brought to tears and crying, which granted he does a lot on the air, but nonetheless, this is why you don't look to a politician, regardless of who it is, regardless of how much you like them, regardless of how much they agree with you, to be your savior. I actually saw this in a tweet the other night by my buddy Cody Poe, who has co-hosted with me on here on the program before, back when I was the Patriot Preacher, that he found that there was someone with quite a large Twitter following saying that Donald Trump is the savior of Western civilization. Don't ever look to a politician, regardless of how much you agree with them, to be your savior. You guys know how much I have talked about and how much I admire and respect the work that has been done by guys like Ted Cruz and Mike Lee and Rand Paul. They're not saviors. And I've never thought of them as saviors, and nobody should think of them as saviors. They are fallible human beings that make mistakes just like everybody else. And they would tell you that. And sometimes I agree with them. With the exception of Mike Lee, I can think of at least a couple of examples with either Rand or Ted Cruz just off the top of my head that I've had a disagreement with. Mike Lee, I kind of disagreed with at least one time. But my point in all of that is, agree or disagreement isn't even the most important thing. Never look to a fallible human being to be your savior in any respect, whether it's politics or anything else. People are people. And when you put people on pedestals, when you put people up on that high position, That just gives them that much farther to fall when they disappoint you. 860-1440. We'll be right back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Galatians 5:1. It was for freedom that Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440. That is the way to get in touch with me if you are interested in doing so. And I do want to change topics here for a second. We're going to get into something that is quite interesting, but I wanted to read this comment real quickly by AJ first, because he is weighing in on Facebook, like I said, because Twitter was down because of, you know, the Russians attacking. No, I'm kidding. But anyway, AJ writes in, "Brother Caleb, Sean Hannity is important because he is Sean Hannity, and the libs think that they can get a two-for-one deal trying to take out Trump. They would love to take out a conservative like Hannity, who, for the most part, takes up for conservatives." And he goes on and explains a little bit further, but no, I actually think AJ is 100% right there. They don't actually have any way to explain how. In other words, they don't really know how this makes Hannity look bad, but they're kind of talking about it as though it does. And you're right that the motivation is that they want to bring Hannity down. I mean, I understood that. I maybe didn't articulate it all that well earlier, but certainly they would love to see Hannity go down. They've tried to bring Hannity down before with allegations from different women that turned out to be not credible at all. They've tried to take him down by boycotting his sponsors. We saw the same thing with Laura Ingraham recently with Media Matters. They've boycotted Hannity before. So, I mean, yeah, the liberals would love to take down a guy like Sean Hannity. I just don't see how they believe that this is going to help them in that goal. And that's part of the reason that I fail to see the significance of it. But yeah, thanks so much for your input, Brother AJ. I agree with you wholeheartedly. That is the reason that they're bringing it up. I think that even they really don't understand yet how that would take place, though. Maybe I'm wrong. Again, maybe I'm missing some kind of key detail, but I really just don't see how this makes Hannity look bad or endangers him in any way. So that being said, I wanted to talk about something else really funny that happened the other day. Maybe I should get serious here for a second. Because, guys, we finally done it. And when I say we, I mean conservatives and Christians. We have finally taken New York City. We have taken New York City over. The war effort is well underway. We are marching forward. We have made advancements. We have outposts. We have people on the ground in New York. We are on the verge of taking New York City back for the Christians. And how are we going to do it? Chicken sandwiches. That's right. The war effort is going on. We have almost retaken New York City because there are Chick-fil-A's now spread all throughout the Big Apple, and we're about to take that city back. Or at least that's how you would think that some of these meetings and some of talk radio would be speaking, based on the latest article from The New Yorker by Dan Pippenbring, I believe is the way to say his name. And this is the headline in this is just the whole article is really just a gem. Chick-fil-A's creepy infiltration of New York City is the title of this thing. And here's a glowing example of that famous liberal tolerance that we're constantly hearing about. Here's just a little snippet of what this article is like. We're going to go ahead and start here. New York has taken to Chick-fil-A. One of the Manhattan locations estimates it sells a sandwich every 6 seconds, and the company has announced plans to open as many as a dozen more storefronts in the city. And yet the brand's arrival here feels like an infiltration. In no small part because of its pervasive Christian traditionalism. Christian traditionalism, I guess that means believing what the Bible says? Wouldn't that be traditionalism, that you read the Bible and say, oh, okay, that's what the Bible says, that's what I believe. I guess that's the Christian traditionalism he's talking about. Anyway, he continues on. Its headquarters in Atlanta are adorned with Bible verses and a statue of Jesus washing a disciple's feet. Its store closes on Sundays. Its CEO, Dan Carthy, has been accused of bigotry for using the company's charitable wing to fund anti-gay causes, including groups that oppose same-sex marriage. Quote, we're inviting God's judgment on our nation, he once said. We shake our fist at him and say, we know better than you what constitutes a marriage. The company has since reaffirmed its identity, its intention to, quote, treat every person with honor, dignity, and respect, but has quietly continued to donate to anti-LGBT groups. When its first standalone store in New York opened in 2015, a throng of protesters appeared. When the location opened in a Queens mall in 2016, Mayor Bill de Blasio proposed a boycott. No such controversy greeted the opening of the newest outpost. And apparently he's upset about this. Chick-fil-A's success is a marketing coup. Its expansion raises a question about what we expect from our fast food and to what extent a corporation can join a community. So this whole thing, he apparently has an issue with the headquarters in Atlanta, not the stores in New York, the one in Atlanta, having a statue of Jesus washing the apostles' feet, Bible verses. Why is this something that is such a bad thing? See, because here's one thing that I find interesting about this. He doesn't actually make an argument that this is something that is a problem. He basically just throws it out there as though that alone is enough to shock people into saying, oh my gosh, we need to rethink about whether or not we should be spending money at Chick-fil-A. Why does it bother him that there's a statue of Jesus washing the apostles' feet? Why does it bother him that there are Bible verses all over the wall in the Atlanta headquarters? I don't understand why that's an issue for him. He doesn't explain why it's an issue for him. Maybe if he did, or maybe if he had a legitimate reason that sounded reasonable, he should have put it in there. But he doesn't. He just kind of puts that out there as though that alone should be enough to invoke the scorn and disdain of the people reading this article. And then he goes in to say, and now this I at least understand where he's coming from, even though he's completely wrong. He talks about it giving to anti-LGBT groups. I don't know what exactly he's going from on that. I don't know what groups he's talking about because he doesn't name them. Again, not really much of an argument, more of a claim that he just throws out there and then gives no evidence to substantiate it. I don't know if, you know, being anti-LGBT could be like, for example, Focus on the Family, just a organization that believes what God believes and what the Bible teaches when it comes to marriage. Not necessarily the idea that he's trying to give here is that they're giving to groups that go out and, I guess, search for gay people to club in the middle of the night or to massacre or something like that. That's kind of the tone of this article and the way he tries to present it. But there's, again, no evidence for that. And apparently he's upset that the mayor has not boycotted or proposed a boycott for the newest location of Chick-fil-A. Which I think it's weird for a public official to protest a business coming into his city anyway. That, to me, seems odd. I mean, we're talking about a chicken sandwich place here. It's not as though every time you go to get a sandwich at this place, they try to evangelize or they, with every time you talk to them, they give you a Bible verse or something like that. This is not something that what I find so strange about it is apparently just by merely existing and saying these are the things that we believe. It's not like the mission statement is written inside every chicken sandwich or you have to recite a Bible verse to be served there. Like, it's weird that they talk about this as being some kind of movement where people are proselytizing. It's a fast food joint. Can we all have a little bit of perspective here and take in and keep in mind that this is a business that serves chicken sandwiches? Because he seems to be forgetting that it's not as though they don't allow gay and lesbian people to eat there. It's not as though they don't allow gay and lesbian people to work there. They're an equal opportunity employer. They don't believe in that sort of thing. It's just that the CEO, because he is a Christian, because he believes in what the Bible teaches, he lets his employees off on Sunday. That's another thing I think is weird. They're like, how dare he let his employees off on Sunday? I thought one of the funniest explanations of this was actually written on the wall of a Chick-fil-A that I visited one time, where it actually said, we're not trying to make a political statement, we're just tired, which I thought was hilarious. The idea that a business gives its employees Sundays off to go worship, it's not saying that you must go to worship on your day off. It's just saying, look, if you'd like to do that, we're not going to make you work then because we're not open then. This liberal idea that you must be compelled to think and act exactly like I think and act, and you must reflect that in your business practices is completely absurd. We'll read a little bit more about this when we come back.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
The Bible is a book worth more than all the other books that were ever printed. Patrick Henry.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 is the way to get in touch with me, or you can tweet me at Tactics Radio. And going along with this article that was published in The New Yorker about how Chick-fil-A is a creepy infiltration of New York City, some of this is just, I don't know. Let's go ahead and just read a little bit more of it. I noticed that the word community is scattered everywhere in the Fulton Street restaurant. A shelf of children's books bears a plaque testifying to our love for this community. The tables are made from reclaimed wood, which creates, according to Chick-fil-A's press release, an inviting space to build a community. A blackboard with the header Our Community displays chalk drawing the city's skyline. Outside, you can see a glimpse of an earlier iteration of a skyline of the building's facade, which, with two tall, imperious rectangles jutting out, gives a subtle impression of the Twin Towers. This emphasis on community, especially the misguided reference to 9/11, suggests an ulterior motive. The restaurant's corporate purpose still begins with the words to glorify God, and that proselytism thrums below the surface of the Fulton Street restaurant, which has the Estrez homespun ambiance of a megachurch. David Farmer, Chick-fil-A's vice president of restaurant experience, told BuzzFeed that he strives for a pit crew efficiency, but where you feel like you just got hugged in the process. Well, if that doesn't prove how evil Chick-fil-A is, I don't know what does. They want to feel like you just got hugged by the service that they give. How dare they? That's sexual assault, I believe, isn't it? Does that constitute a sexual assault? Hashtag me too. For Chick-fil-A. Shame on you. This is just one of the most whiny, ridiculous, over-the-top things that I have ever read. And he's saying that there's a misguided nod to 9/11. He hates the fact that they are talking about being involved with the community, which, by the way, he doesn't mention this, but another thing Chick-fil-A does is they're actually a very green company, which would drive people up the wall that this Christian conservative company also does a lot of recycling. Their tables are made from repurposed wood. The benches outside and also benches that they donate are made from the recycled remains of their styrofoam cups. You know, the big styrofoam cups that Chick-fil-A has at their restaurants with the sweet tea and everything? Those styrofoam cups are actually recycled and made into things like benches. And so I'm sure that it absolutely drives liberals crazy that they do stuff like that, that they're very community conscious place. But he says, well, even that, it's not really because they want to be a member of the community. It's not because they want to fit in or they want to make people feel welcome. It's because they're really proselytizing people. And he talks about glorifying God being the opening part of their mission statement. Just out of curiosity, how many people actually read a company's mission statement? Like when you go to any other chain restaurant, whether you go to a fast food place like McDonald's or you go to a place like Moe's or you go to a sit-down restaurant like Longhorn, do you sit down and get ready to eat and do you read the mission statement? Like, I could kind of see where he was coming from if they, the employees, again, were trying to evangelize people or you had to, I don't know, recite a Bible verse or something when you walked in. But even if it's written up on the wall somewhere, which it may be, I don't know, it depends on the location. There probably are some Chick-fil-A restaurants that have the mission statement up there somewhere on a plaque or something. But even if it's there, the idea that saying we want to glorify God is bludgeoning people into being a Christian, you have a really low bar of proselytizing if that's the case. In fact, if you're looking at the scripture, if you're looking at the example given by the Bible, it would definitely not classify that as evangelism. Not saying that Chick-fil-A should be evangelizing as a business, just saying that that wouldn't be something that counts as evangelism even by the biblical definition. And so it's just so, it just comes off as so smug and angry at the same time. It's so ridiculous. Another one that he brings up, and just to get even more ridiculous than that, this is a few paragraphs down. If the restaurant is a megachurch, then the cows are the ultimate evangelist. Since their introduction in the mid-90s when they began advertising Atlanta motorists to eat more chicken, they've remained one of the most popular and most morbid advertising campaigns in the fast food industry, crucial to Chick-fil-A's corporate culture. S. Truly Cathy, the chain's founder and Dan Carthy's late father, saw them as a tool to spread the gospel of chicken. He goes on talking about how he doesn't understand why they would be included when most companies try to distance themselves from what he calls the brutalities of the slaughterhouse, and that when people look at cows now, they think of Chick-fil-A, so we have co-opted an entire species. It works because it's funny. It works because it's ironic to think that cow... I mean, this is why the whole bit is humorous and why it's clever, is that you're thinking about the cows that they would be self-aware enough, which, by the way, if you know anything about agriculture, it's actually incredibly inaccurate because the Chick-fil-A cows are dairy cattle anyway. A Holstein, which is the breed that they are, they're dairy cattle. They're not meat cattle. Obviously, they get made into meat eventually, but their primary purpose is production of milk and dairy products. But anyway... ironically, in looking into that, it's just funny to think about cows would be sentient enough and aware enough that they would want to prevent people from eating burgers, and so they would encourage people to eat chicken. That idea is funny, and that's why it works. That's all there is to it. It's just ironic. It's not trying to call forward the ideas of the brutalities of the slaughterhouse or anything like that, talking about these cows as though they're evangelists for the gospel of chicken. It's just a joke. Some people, I really do think, go through life just hunting for things to be offended by and take things far too seriously. It's just funny to think that cows would encourage people to eat chicken because it would save their skin. That's hilarious. Because, of course, we know that cows don't do that. That's why animals in general invoking any kind of human-like trait is funny, because we know that it's not real. We know that it's silly, because animals obviously don't do that. And so it's funny to think, what would animals be like if they were more like people? And that's why the cow bit works. Because there is there's a bit of self-reflection in there that was like, yeah, if I was a cow, I probably would do that. That's why it's funny. That's why the bit works. And he goes on, and I'll real quickly do this before we get to the chaplain's report. One thing that he talks about is he says that another reason that Chick-fil-A is really evil is that they have and promote a deadening uniformity. So in other words, like every other chain restaurant that exists, and I'm not even talking about just fast food, because y'all, McDonald's and Burger King look pretty much alike, but that's true of, for example, a Longhorn. You ever been in a Longhorn? They all look pretty much exactly the same. You ever been to a Logan Steakhouse? They all pretty much look the same. You ever been to an Olive Garden? They all pretty much look the same. That's what a chain restaurant is. It's a restaurant that you know exactly what you're going to get regardless of what location you happen to be in. That's why the uniformity thing works. That's true of every chain restaurant. If that's a problem and that's a reason to believe that Chick-fil-A is evil and ought to be cast out of New York, then that's true of every chain restaurant that has ever been in New York City. And this is what this really all goes back to. First of all, there is a level of hypocrisy here, because you're seeing this. They talk about tolerance. They talk about diversity. Think about this. Which one is more tolerant? For Chick-fil-A and their CEO, not even the company, but the person who founded it, saying, I disagree with homosexuality. I think that it's wrong. I think that it's self-destructive. And because of that, I want people to stop doing it because I think they're wrong. Or, get out of our city, infiltrators. You don't belong here. Seriously, which one is more tolerant? And it is ironic for the New Yorker, of all things, to be doing this, because that is a city that has often prided itself on diversity, apparently. That's only the case if it's a diversity of talk. He talks about Christians and Christian ideas as though they're a pest infestation or a plague. Get out of our city, lepers. You might infect the rest of us. And apparently he believes that chicken sandwiches are the greatest threat to New York. But nonetheless, Chick-fil-A is very successful there. And what does that tell you? Because he even acknowledges that Chick-fil-A has been fairly successful in New York City, that they're selling like crazy, that people really like the brand. What does that tell you? That this guy's opinions are not shared by most New Yorkers. Even most New Yorkers, despite being liberal, they understand it's a chicken sandwich place. They're not proselytizing us. They're not trying to convert us to their way of thinking. It's a chicken place. I'm going in there for a chicken sandwich and some waffle fries. And that's the thing. Most people are like that because when it comes to me, I don't really care much what a personal stance of a CEO or people that work at the company are when I go to use their product or buy something from them. Now, I care about companies that give to left-wing causes, that donate, for example, to Planned Parenthood or Every Town for Gun Safety or some cause like that. Then I might consider not necessarily, purchasing something from them. And if they promote a left-wing cause, like, for example, Target did that we talked about, where they promote the transgender bathroom thing, where they have open displays for Gay Pride Month, things like that, then I might consider not necessarily going to them. But I don't think I've ever convinced anybody else not to. And this vitriolic, just absolute disdain for Christian ideals in any form, even when they're not overt, I think that this is why Christians really do believe that we're under attack and our ideas are under attack, and why we feel as though that's been the case for a while. But my advice would be, let us to do the best that we can to overcome evil with good. To, when we're met with this kind of animosity, do the best that we can to show the love and the mercy of Christ. Chaplain's Report is next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Hebrews 13, 5 and 6. Make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. So that we confidently say, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What will man do to me?
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. Chaplain's Report is on right now. And our Chaplain's Report today comes from Proverbs 21, verse 13. He says, he who shuts his ear to the cry of the poor will also cry himself and not be answered. There is this idea that is pervasive throughout the entirety of the Old and New Testament, that the decisions that we make in life, the choices that we make, whether we choose to be moral or immoral, is going to affect the way we are also treated by others. Now, the Bible is very clear. Sometimes you're going to do the best that you can. Sometimes you're going to do right by everybody, and terrible things are still going to happen to you. There's no clearer example of that ever happening than, of course, in Jesus Christ, who was perfect, who always treated people with respect and love and compassion, and despite that, was murdered for a crime he didn't commit. And there's no greater example of unfairness anywhere in the Bible, and yet, one of the things that the Bible makes very clear is that from a spiritual standpoint, if you choose to act immorally, you are going to bear the consequences of your choices, both in eternity when it comes to the judgment, but also to a certain degree here as well. Because what it's saying here in Proverbs is that if you do ignore the cries of the poor, eventually what's going to happen is you're going to be the one crying out, and there will be nobody to hear your cries. There will be nobody to answer your call, just like you didn't answer the call of others. And so when it comes to talking about the poor, when it comes to talking about our duties to take care of each other, love one another, and do the best that we can to ensure that we are doing right by other people, by God's children, there is this expectation that we are supposed to act in such a way that conveys the love of Christ, that does the best that we can to take care of one another. If we don't, we will be punished. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.